Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
There are 85 million poor and low-income people who are eligible to vote in this country. 85 million. And it's time now to wake up that sleeping giant and for them to use their power. Bishop William J. Barber II is the president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach and national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. In 2018, he helped relaunch the Poor People's Campaign, which was begun by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, starting with an historic wave of protests in state capitals and in Washington, D.C. Since then, that Poor People's Campaign has continued its incredible work and is launching a 42-week campaign to mobilize 15 million poor and low-wage voters, because low-income people have the power to not only decide elections, but also to change the conversation about what is possible in America. We're going to have a conversation with the bishop coming up right here on the Michael Steele podcast, right after this. Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I am excited to have you join us in conversation as always. And I'm particularly happy that you could be with us today as we talk about something that we spend very little time talking about in this country, and that is the poor amongst us. As the Lord told us when he walked this earth, we will always have them, which was a charge he's given to us to do something about. And we are really happy to welcome to the conversation today someone who's doing his level best to address poverty in this country, and that is the Right Reverend Bishop Barber. Welcome, Bishop. It's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast, my friend.
Thank you, Brother Steele, and I'm glad we can be here. Thank you for your voice, witness, and clarity. And as I look sometimes at you on the TV, as my grandmother used to say, just telling the truth. You know, that's a good thing. Just tell the truth.
And that's it. And you know, and I have to tell folks, you have been doing that for some time. I have been an admirer from afar for a while, and then we had the opportunity to connect and have stayed connected ever since, talking about the mission that you have right now and the work that you're doing right now, recognizing the number of poor people we have in this country, which is estimated at over 85 million of our neighbors, friends, and families are poor or low income folks who are disenfranchised from voting and disenfranchised from fully participating in the system in other ways, getting economic opportunity, getting a strong baseline foundation for education. Talk to us a little bit about the sort of national state of poverty in the country. And then I want to get into some of the work you're doing specifically around the Third Reconstruction Agenda.
Well, you know, one of the things, one of my professors in seminary when I was at Duke said, if you're going to try to speak in what's called the prophetic tradition or public theology tradition, don't be loud and wrong. So do always get you a bunch of researchers and right. The best and the students. The prophets of the Bible were deeply researched. You know, Jesus, when he opened his first sermon, he said, preach good news to the poor. And even when you do, Michael, word study around the word that's chosen, the poor in that particular context, it means those who have been poor, made poor by economic violence. He's not talking about those who are poor by refusal to do this or that, but the economic violence. And he said, I have to preach good news. Evangel is the word. So there's really no evangelical stance for a person of Christian faith that's not concerned about the poor. And then, as you know, I'm a preacher, so I have to root what I say in the word. Over in the book of Isaiah chapter 10, it says, woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights. And in the Hebrew text, the right of the poor is a right to not be poor if the systems are fair. In other words, you can't create unfair systems. And so one of the things we did this study called The Souls of Poor Folk. Repairs of the Breach is a co-anchor of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, along with the Kairos Center, my dear sister, Reverend Dr. Liz Steele Harris. And in that study, we found that in 2018, and this is not blaming any administration, just looking at where we are, 140 million poor and or low wage, and you have to add the two, poor and or low wage or low wealth individuals, 140 million. That's 43% of the country. That's 52% of the children at that time who were $500 away from economic ruin. Then we found out that there were over 50 million people who work every day but make less than a living wage of $15 an hour. And then, Michael, we found out that the minimum wage had not been raised since 2009, which is $7.25, $2.13 for people who work in the restaurant industry. And then we found out that Nobel Peace Prize scholars had looked at raising the minimum wage to actually what the March on Washington called for. You know, a lot of people forget that, one of the agenda items of the March on Washington was to raise the minimum wage 75 cents index with inflation, right? So where we are real quickly today, we went through COVID, and interestingly, poverty dropped during the implementation of many of the programs during COVID to 112 million poor and low wealth. And 60% of children were snatched out of poverty when we passed the child income tax credit. But those things have expired. They're over. So now poverty is back up to 135 million poor and low wage folk. 87 million are eligible to vote, but actual number 135 poor and low wealth. Some 80 plus million people who are either uninsured or underinsured, and over 50 some million who make less than living wage. And let me say this last thing, then go look at the next question when you ask me. We went through COVID, and this is something I shudder about. And we changed people's title from service worker to essential worker. But in policy, we did not treat them as essential. We treated them as expendable because we sent them to work with less than a living wage, no paid family leave, many of them, and no guaranteed health insurance in the middle of a pandemic. We blew whistles about them. We played bells. We celebrated them and said how great it was that they worked for the rest of us. But many of them didn't even make a living wage, didn't even have health care. That, for me, is not a Republican question. It's not a Democratic question. It is what Philip Austin, who's the UN rapporteur on poverty, said to me. It is a moral question. It's a deeply moral question.
So let's put a pin in that point and expand on it a little bit, because I think there always seems to be this conflict between our moral commitment and our societal obligation. And it is interesting to me how we diminish that obligation by making excuse on the moral side, and we diminish the moral side by lifting up the societal obligation. In other words, like, oh, it's going to cost so much, and therefore we can't care for the poor. Or you get the reverse argument where it's like, oh, we have to be profoundly important, and it's profoundly important that we focus on the poor, but then nobody wants to actually lean into the programs
that's right
that will actually do that. That's you right. have found a way to frame both and to show that this is not an either or conversation, that this is a and conversation. Our moral obligation and our societal commitment, they go hand in hand. And that really, and one of the things that I'll admit my bias, when I first heard of the Poor People's Campaign, I was skeptical. I was like, oh, here we go. You know, liberals being liberal.
That's right.
You're right. But then I did the thing that you said at the very beginning, and I did something my mama said I should always do. You said at the beginning about how, you know, you draw people's attention into the conversation. You cannot, you know, just put stuff out there that you have to come with the facts. You have to come mm-hmm. with the information. You have to inform and educate in order to inspire and move people. And my mama just told me to shut up and listen. and I did both those things, and I realized that what you were telling us, whether it's through the Poor People's Campaign or through your writings or other things that you'd focused on in terms of getting people in the space of the poor in this country, was elevating up the fact that this isn't a choice that Christ gave us. He didn't say you have, you know, you can choose the poor or something else.
Right. And it's not a choice we can make as a democracy. I mean,
right.
Think about it. If over a third of your people are poor and low wealth, and you don't address that, you are endangering the economic health of the nation. And for the way I discuss morality, I look at it through the lens of the prophetic language and Jesus and other writers. They never separated the two. Like, the moral was the feeling good, and the actual economic program was then the practical side. No. If you look at, for instance, in the book of Ezekiel, he talks about, what do you do when your politicians have become like wolves and they rob people of their rights? And then the religious people go along with the dictators and the despots rather than standing on the side of justice. Or our own Constitution says establishing justice, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare are not optional. Those are not just kind of feel good things. That is what our policies are supposed to reflect. Right. In other words, when we write a policy, we ought to be able to set the preamble to the Constitution on top of that policy as the grid and say, does this policy establish justice? Does this policy promote the general welfare? Does it provide for the common defense? Now, when we think about that, Michael, first of all, the cost of poverty. It costs more for us to keep children in poverty. It costs more for us not to have health care. It costs more for us not to pay a living wage, because if you don't pay a living wage, then you have to turn around and pay for food stamps and everything else.
Right.
It actually undermines our economic health when we don't engage in how do we fix this issue. And then secondly, about seven bills, if we were to pass them and get past partisanism, they would lift 90% of the poor out of poverty and low wealth and benefit the country. And about 60 or 70% of all Americans agree. And for instance, in Mississippi now, there was a poll the other day that said 60% of Republicans now agree with the Affordable Care Act, because they're finding out that if you're sick, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat.
That's true.
it doesn't matter.
That's true. One of the states that refused to embrace it. At,
exactly.
You know? Exactly.
And then a pandemic hits and you say, I don't have any health care. And it doesn't matter if you're black or you're white. You know, take for instance this fact. I'm going to set aside for a minute. And we had to do this even with some, quote, liberals, because when we first did our analysis, we then broke that $140 million down into demographics. And then we broke it down into raw numbers. And I had some so-called liberal friends say, now, when you get to the raw numbers, we can't do that. I said, why? Because it's going to show that there are more poor white people than there are than poor black.
Well, and hello black there.
And black folk going to get offended. I said, are you crazy? I said, we actually need to look at it. So the demographics showed us that 60.9% of black people are poor and or low wealth, low wage.
Right.
But that was about 26 million people. 30% of white people are poor and low wage. That was 66 million people. So it was 40 million more. And yet, when we talk about poverty politically in this country, what is the attempt often to split people? Then, looked at this, and I'll stop here. What if, let's take all the politics, now all of the rhetoric of division aside, what would you do if you were a president of a country and you knew something existed in that country that was the fourth leading cause of death, that was killing more people than homicide and respiratory disease and heart problems? What, it was the fourth leading cause of death, and it could be corrected. It didn't have to exist. Well, that's exactly what poverty and low wealth is today. The fourth leading cause of death in this country. 800 and some odd people a day. Nearly over 250,000 people a year. And that's not my numbers. The Mailman School of Public Policy in Columbia did a study on it. A new professor now has written a whole book on it. There's another professor that's written a book called Poverty, not Poverty in America, but Poverty by America. The uniqueness of poverty in America, where you have so much affluence. What do you do? When we got to 500 people dying a day from COVID, we said, hey, stop it.
Yeah.
Find a vaccine.
Yeah. Well, what's the vaccine for poverty, right?
Exactly. And we know what it is. If we did 58 senators, Democrats and Republicans, so I just say senators, in the middle of COVID, said no to raising the minimum wage to $15. Now, the studies tell us for a family of four, a living wage is a $25 total for that family. We have politicians that tell us, I've heard them say it to me, that if you make $7.25 an hour, that gives you a little bit over $14,000 a year, and you're not poor, because if you make $13,000 a year, you're not poor. You're in the lower middle class.
Right.
You know, it's absurd and obscene morally.
So Bishop, why is it so hard then? What is the stumbling block that you have found, and those who work in the areas that impact children, that impact moms, mm-hmm. that impact those with addictions, mm-hmm. Those things that feed poverty. Mm-hmm. And in some instances create poverty, or poverty mm-hmm. winds up creating them. You because mm-hmm. you cannot provide for your family, you turn to a life of crime, or you mm-hmm. just you go inward and therefore become self-absorbed to the point mm-hmm. of addiction. What mm-hmm. what is it then that makes our society so mm-hmm. unwilling to care for the poor, mm-hmm. given the wealth that we generate in Black communities, Hispanic communities, mm-hmm. white communities, all communities across the nation?
Well, you know, it's complicated, because there is one theory of thought that poverty is people's moral failings. And so way back when the New Deal was first passed, there was a group of religionists that came together, and they worked with people like Sun Oil and some of the big folk to come up with this pseudo-Calvinism that says if you do good, you go to heaven. If you do bad, you go to hell. So if you do good, you're going to at least be middle class or rich. If you do bad, it's because you're poor. And so if you're poor, it's your own fault. And if you put any program in place that helps lift up the poor, then you undermine their facing the consequences of their lifestyle. That's out there. The other side is that we don't put a face on it. There are three things I'd say. A face on it.
Yeah, we don't.
What does poverty, we don't break it down. The number.
And on that point, real quick, Bishop, mm-hmm. and oftentimes to the point you were making earlier, the face that we put on it is a black or brown face, totally exactly. excluding the white face, which exactly. tend to be more poor, or at least the numbers are larger.
If you will. The largest number of poor and low wealth people in this country are working people, the biggest number of white women with children. I've been in Appalachia. White poor women who were mad as all get out at Manchin when he voted against raising the minimum wage to 15, because he had told him he would if he got elected. And they, at least he said he would raise it to 12 or 13, and he voted to just not raise it at all.
Right.
These women sell tacos on Tuesday. to put a fund together to help each other with their menstrual cycle. What if we saw that on the news? You know, what if we put a face on? So not putting a face on the ugliness of poverty and low wages. Number two is the constant lies that are told that if you do certain kinds of things, it's going to cause inflation. I was looking at one station this morning, and they were talking about we have to protect against wage inflation because wage inflation is what causes inflation. Well, actually, that is a thought, economic thought. But there are other theories that says, no, it's not wage inflation. It's greed, it's price gouging, it's epidemics, and it's war. Those are the things that drive up costs.
Right.
But it's amazing that everybody wants a raise until it comes to poor folk, and then all of a sudden wage inflation is a problem. The last thing, though, I think, Mike, is that 140 million poor and low-wealth people in this country before COVID, 135 million today, we had 15 presidential debates, and not one talked about what was going on among 40% of the nation and 51% of the children. If your political conversations are that weak and diluted, if the political conversations, you know, we want to talk about the color somebody's hair running for campaign, or how many times did they curse, or all kinds of stuff we want to talk about. But you can run for president of this country or senator in this country and never be asked, what will you do? Or what is your plan to address the a reality that causing nearly 250,000 people to die a year? That is called an impoverished democratic debate, which leads to an impoverished democracy because we're not faced. And the number one reason, we did a study called Waking the Sleeping Giant. We did it with a scholar out of Columbia because I wanted to know. You know, I had always heard poor white people vote against their own interest. Study said, no, they don't. The study says, no, that's not true. I had always heard that poor people just don't vote. Not true. 57 million voted. Now, they don't vote at the same proportion. But I wonder what, and the number one reason, Mike, was not even voter suppression. As much as I have fought against voter suppression and still will and believe it's wrong, the number one reason was nobody talks to us.
Yeah.
No, nobody talks to us, comes around. I went to Harlan County. Quick, I know you got to take a break. I went to Harlan County, Kentucky. You know that. That's up in East Kentucky, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's where Justice Harlan came from, who was a justice on the Supreme Court, the only one that voted against Plessy versus Ferguson, Justice Harlan. And I went out there. People said, you're crazy for going out there. I said, no, that's God's people too. About 300 or 400 people, mostly white, showed up. And we talked about what was going on among them. We talked about how there were politicians back there, you know, telling them to vote again for this, but not ever talking about poverty. And one of them said to me, Reverend Barber, you know, the last time a presidential candidate came back here, and I said, when? They said, Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he launched the war on poverty.
Wow.
And I said, how do you all feel about that? They said, we feel like we don't matter. And I said, so are these counties red? I said, I don't like using the term red and blue. I just don't. But I had, for sake of conversation, they said, no, these are not red or blue counties. These are just uninspired, unorganized counties where people are just trying to make, because they think all the politicians are just full of, you know what.
Right.
Because nobody goes back there and says, if you elect me, I'm going to at least fight for you to have a chance. I'm fight for living wages. I'm going to fight for some decent health care for all of you. And I'm going to fight back there, water rights and a few other things. It was interesting that Bershear in Kentucky, after our campaign was there, we never endorsed it. We don't endorse candidates.
Right.
But he chose to go back to those counties. He chose to run against an incumbent, but to go to Eastern Kentucky and say to folk, I'm going to be serious about health care. Do you know 4 or 5 of those counties flipped in 2018? Mm-hmm. In Kentucky now. I'm not talking about in New York or in Kentucky, of all places. And so we got to put a face on this. We have to tell people the real numbers. And we're going to have to stop leaving this issue out of the political debates and conversations of our culture.
We're talking to Bishop William J. Barber II. And we're talking poverty. We're talking power. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little politics and how the bishop and through a lot of his work are trying to leverage up the opportunity for the poor to leverage their vote come election time around their issues. More with Bishop Barber right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am delighted to have in conversation with us today, Bishop William Barber, president and senior lecturer of repairers of the breach and national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Bishop, you before we went to break, you kind of laid out the landscape and the truth of that landscape and the impact of communities, not communities of one color or another, but all communities who are trapped in poverty. One of the efforts that you have underway right now is a national effort that's wrapped in legislation known as Third Reconstruction. What is that? House Resolution 438 speaks to this effort to address some of the things that we've been talking about.
Well, Mike, you know, we had so far two reconstructions in this country that did great things, but both of them were ended either through violence or through legislative destruction and judicial destruction. The first was the first reconstruction after slavery that gave us the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, and led this country out of a lot of some of the vestiges of slavery. Then you had the second reconstruction from 54 to about 68, if you will, Brown versus Board of Education, then eventually the Medicare, Medicaid, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, all came out of great struggle. But as you know, those movements were assassinated and undermined and so forth. We didn't finish the job. And we need a reconstruction that finishes the job for a fair and decent democracy. It's not just having a democracy, but what kind of democracy is worth having. We wrote a resolution that laid out 20 some steps and said to senators and to congressmen, if you believe, this wasn't even to pass it. It was say, do you have the resolve to at least have the debate on living wages, on health care for all, on a fair, affordable housing, fully funded public education, women's right to their lives, because when women's rights are taken, mostly poor women get hurt, ending the profiteering and the proliferation around guns, making sure that we have a fair taxation policy, making sure that we look heavily at the bloatedness in the military budget and what could be used toward fighting the battles of poverty in this country. That was the resolution. Now, what we are doing is we had a Moral Poverty Action Congress in June of 2023. And after dealing with poverty equaling death, 14 causes of death, we decided that poor and low-wage people, and they decided, because the 1,200 delegates, they were all poor, low-wealth, and religious leaders and others, that we can't wait until people talk to us. We must be pushed to be talked to and whatnot. So we did some numbers again, and here what they are. One thing, I was at the Vatican. You're Catholic, right?
Yes.
Right. I was invited by the Pope and his Monsignor and Jeffrey Sachs to be at the Vatican to be on to be a part of a Pontifical Policy Academy. And one day I was sitting there with Jeffrey Sachs, and we were in this room that Galileo, Galileo, and all those were in there. And I just turned to him and said, "Has anybody looked at poverty and COVID in America?" And he said, "No, I don't know." He said, "Would you do it? Would your team work with us? We commissioned it. We did. We found out that poor and low wealth people, regardless of color, whether it was West Virginia or Mississippi, were 3 to 5 times higher to die from COVID, not because the germ discriminated, but because of the way services were not delivered to the poor. And out of all of this death, folk are starting to say, wait a minute, we have to live, we have to rise up. And we started flipping the numbers over, Mike. Like, for instance, if there are 135 million poor, low-wealth people in the country, well, how many voters are there? And what we found, we commissioned another study, Waking the Sleeping Giant, The Power of Poor and Low-Wealth Voters. Here's what we found. In battleground states, where the margin of victory is within 3%, poor and low-wealth voters make up from 34 to 42% of the vote. In battleground states, where the margin of victory is within 3%, there is not a state where if 20% of poor and low-wealth voters were to be mobilized, they could not overcome the margin of victory, the presidential election, Senate election. In fact, we found that in many of those states, the margin was less than 2%, where, for instance, you might have, like in Michigan, 1 million poor and low-wealth voters that didn't vote, but in 2016, the margin of victory wasn't but 10,000 votes. Or in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Or in Wisconsin, or in North Carolina, the margin of victory in the presidential election was 170,000 votes, but the number of poor and low-wealth voters that didn't vote was almost 1 million. What do you do with that kind of power, right? You can't just say nobody's talking to us. You have to flip that over at some point and say, wait a minute, we have a power here that if we mobilize it, and there's not a state in the country where if 30% of poor and low-wage voters who have not voted were to vote, that they could not affect outcomes of election. In fact, poor and low-wealth people tend to vote about 22% less than others. They vote, but they're not voting their strength. So what we decided was, you can talk all day long in a democracy, all day long. But my Jewish rabbi friend taught me something that I will never forget. I was with him one day, and they said, "Rabbi Bobby, do you know that the word for vote and the word for voice is the same word in Hebrew?" I said, "Get out of here." They said, "No, go look it up." So I did. You know, I don't use my Hebrew every day from seminary, but every night I go back, pick it up. So there's this great text, Mike, and you know it, Isaiah 58. It says, "Cry loud and spare not." Down in there it says that you shall be called to repairs of the breach. Then it says, "Loose the bands of wickedness," which means pay people what they deserve. But before you get to all of that, it says, "Cry loud and spare not. Lift up your trumpet like a voice, like a shout." The word trumpet, there's shofar. The word voice, there is coil. The same word coil means vote. So we started saying, wait a minute. If your vote is your voice, then you cannot shut down your vote, or you are shutting up your voice.
Yeah.
So what if we could mobilize 15 million poor and low-wage voters? Touch them. So we're launching on March the 2nd. In 33 state capitals and D.C., a massive campaign in those states to touch over 42 weeks to touch multiple times 15 million infrequent voters, and basically say, if you believe in a living wage, if you believe in health care, you believe in affordable housing, public education, you believe women's right to their health and their bodies, if you believe in ending the proliferation of profiteering around guns, if you believe in hate, love being greater than hate in the public square, and you're sick of the divisions, then join us. Not, we don't need another insurrection. We need a resurrection. In the 60th anniversary of Freedom Summer, we need a resurrection. And you have the ability to determine outcomes of election, but you cannot stay home.
So is that the thrust of the messaging, not to the parties, but to the poor itself. So, you know, going back on the example that to build off the examples that you were giving, when you're looking at the election in 2016, you have Trump carrying Michigan by 10,000 votes. You have roughly 980,000 low wage voters who didn't turn out, as you said, right? You've got a 1.1% then of those voters, if they had just decided to go vote, just 1% of them had decided to go vote, the results would have been different. So what is the thrust of getting the poor to vote? Because a lot of the poor believe that in a variety of ways that they're ineligible to vote. They can't vote. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to vote. They don't know where to vote. And their situation is no different from any other voter once you give them that same information. This is where you vote. This is the process you need to go through. What are you looking at as you're looking at not just this cycle that we're in now presidential level, but as you mentioned, the governors of various states, the state elected officials, those people have their hand directly on whether or not programs will be implemented to help the poor. How are you making those connections for them?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we're launching at state capitals and state assemblies, because the great political insurrections are going on in state assemblies. I mean, all you have to do is read Nancy McLean's book on change, democracy and change, and what extremists really want to do through state assemblies, bypass federal law, try to find a way to call a constitutional convention without having to go through the people in Congress. I mean, there's so many things that are happening. One of the things I come out of the Maul Monday movement, where we learn you have to fight at the state assembly level if you're going to really win. And we did that over 4 years with Maul Monday. Not only did we beat one of the worst cases of voter suppression, we pushed back against extremism. We sent a governor home. We never endorsed either way, but we registered 10% new voters and told them and we produced report cards, not partisan report cards, but issue report cards. And they decided that the governor at that time was too extreme because of his stance against voter rights, his stance against immigrants, his stance against women, his stance against employment, raising employment funds and whatnot. So in this process, what we're saying is three things. Number one, we're starting at the state level and these state assemblies. The Poor People's Campaign, we have coordinating committees in all of these states, not new organizations, but coordinating committees made up of poor people, religious leaders, and advocates that are bringing people together. We're launching this launch at these state capitals on March the 2nd. Afterwards, we're also mobilizing a core of people we will train. In 2022, we took 400 people, trained them, and reached over 2.7 million voters. So we were doing what we call a pilot program then. And we actually know where they turned out, how they turned out. We know that one study says that 54% of people making less than $50,000 a year in a family of four, which is a form of low wage and low wealth, actually voted for more progressive candidates. We don't tell for who to vote, but what we are going to do is go down our list of issues and say, here's where folks stand on these issues. Your choice. But here's where they stand, because, you know, politics is never a zero-sum game.
Right.
You have to look at who's closest to your ideals, vote for them, and then stay on them once they get in office. I mean,
yes,
it's always been
that
way.
That's exactly right.
Right. You never get the, you know, Bayard Rustin taught us that. You know, you might have, and when protest is one way or the highway, but politics is going to require compromise, but you don't compromise your principles. But you can't do any compromise if you're not in the game, you're not there. And so what we've looked at, just give you an example. If an organization was to get 200 people in 30 states, train them on how to use technology and the old form of turf, putting your feet to the turf, going door by door, in 10 weeks or less, you 30 states with 200, that's 6,000 people, you can reach 15 million people. So if you do it over 40 weeks, potentially you could touch them four times. Four touches is serious when it comes to mobilization. I've talked to my good friend Celinda Lake about this and actually what it takes to move people.
Right.
The second piece of this, though, is we're raising this up in March. Then on June 15th, we're coming to D.C. for a massive mass consciousness piece led by poor and low-wealth people. We did it in 2023. 2022, thousands of people, tens of thousands showed up, 2.7 million online, and then that's documented in the media. We're coming back June 15th, the mass of poor people always moral march on Washington and to the polls, and then launching the summer initiative, but they're doing it before the conventions. And saying to the convention, whatever your convention is, these voters are going to move. Now, you've got to decide if are you going to speak to them at your convention. You right. have to decide whether you're going to talk to them in your debates. You have to decide whether you're going to put these issues up front. I would suggest that Republicans and Democrats in Congress go ahead on and vote and put living wages on the table and vote on it. I would, and so people know where you are. I would suggest they do that, because what we're saying to these voters are, you have to look at policy, not just personality. Policy. So where do folks stay? Yeah.
So Bishop, what do you say to people who would say, look, you know, after all the march and all mm-hmm. the programs and all the mm-hmm. stuff and mm-hmm. and you know, the studies and everything, you still have a legislature in a given state or the federal level that's not moving the needle, that's not mm-hmm. addressing these concerns. So even with the organization of the vote, the outcome is going to be the same for the poor. How do you address that? How do we begin to make that a lie?
Well, first of all, we show people that we don't really know what state is red or blue because we've never maximized the vote. I mean, the truth of the matter is it only would take 18.6% of the vote that didn't vote to change the outcome in North Carolina. So at some point, I think it's 2% in Florida, is 1% in Michigan, 1% in Wisconsin, 2% in Pennsylvania. I'm just talking about poor and low-wealth folks. So at some point, you have to say, our foreparents did more with less. We can't do less with more. Mm-hmm. I'm very tough on when it comes to those of us that face levels of oppression. I come out of the school of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and others. Let me tell you what that means. When the Dred Scott decision was passed and in the Supreme Court, Frederick Douglass went into a little depression, and Sojourner Truth found him and asked him this question: is God dead? And when he said that question shook him, and he got up from his depression and asked to speak before the Abolition Committee in May of that same year. Mm-hmm. And he said to them, this is a monstrous piece of legislation. It's terrible. It seems like everything is against us. And then he says at the end, but I received this with a cheerful spirit, because just maybe this is a necessary link in the chain of events toward the downfall of the entire system of slavery. Therefore, what they have done has only emboldened and intensified our agitation. Same with Harriet Tubman. She got 700 people out of slavery. She didn't have YouTube, email. I mean, I'm being facetious, but you know.
No,
what I mean.
But yeah, exactly. You know, she had epilepsy, right?
She had epilepsy, and she still went out there. So we, first of all, have to have stop this attitude that things can't change just because they haven't changed. We then have to decide to be an agent of change. I don't know any progressive thing. And I say progressive, not meaning Democrat or Republican. I mean from child welfare laws to Social Security to the minimum wage we have to voting rights. Tell me one of them that was that people thought would happen before it happened. You know, Nelson Mandela right. said the very thing you want will seem impossible up to the day that it becomes possible. But the one thing you have to know, and this is what I come out of this school, faith without works is D-E-A-D, mm-hmm. dead, dead, dead. If you're already poor and low wage, then you know one thing, not participating isn't going to make it any better. I mean, you already know that. You have evidence of that, right? So what you do know, and I go back to something that Dr. King said. I'm probably going to get in trouble on your show, but that's all right.
That's all right.
I actually don't think that I Have a Dream was the greatest speech of Dr. King. I'm going to tell you why. I Have a Dream was a closing. Part of it he got from Prathia Hall and then Langston Hughes' poem about America has never been American to me. He had actually done I Have a Dream in Detroit, North Carolina, several places. I think people heard, after he died, the media pumped I Have a Dream. The speech that day was actually entitled Normalcy Never Again. Normalcy Never Again. And in that speech, he talked about refusing to continue to accept the check coming back marked insufficient fund.
Right.
He said, be careful not to think this is a cooling off. But then in 1965, at the end of the Selma to Montgomery, I think Dr. King gave his greatest speech standing on the steps of the Alabama State House under the threat of being shot. When he went through the first Reconstruction and told the story of what really caused segregation, and he said the real cause of segregation was the fear of the greedy aristocracy of this nation, that the masses of Negroes and poor white people would come together and form a voting bloc that could shift the economic architecture of this country.
That is exactly what he said in that moment.
That's what he said. Doc.
And he put his finger on a powerful, powerful point, because you could see where on that point alone, he and Malcolm X and a host of other folks who were seemingly at odds began to converge around that one idea. Right. At the end of the day, when it came to economic empowerment and freedom, it rested in not the separation, mm-hmm. but the collaboration of mm-hmm. black and white folk.
And what has been the goal, Doc? And what has been, what do we see now? All this division,
yep.
right? With the Southern strategy was about dividing.
Yep.
One group said that their goal was to make the Democrat the Black Party. Another group said their goal was to make Republican this party. But underneath all of it was this fear, right? Poor Negroes and the masses of poor white folk in the South, but over the country, coming together and shifting the economic architecture of the nation. He saw that clearly. Nowhere in that speech, Michael, does he mention Democrat or Republican. He talks about the Voting Rights Act as a part of a tool toward economic justice. And that's what we're saying to folk now. That's what we're saying. We cannot, we have a song that was done by Miss Yara Allen. She wrote it one night when a lady who was dying from coal ash poisoning, because this company decided to poison this community's water, didn't care whether they were black or white. And mm-hmm. and after she wrote it, Yara Allen went to the mic and wrote a song on the spot. She comes out of the Pentecostal tradition and so forth and so on. And her song was, somebody's been hurting my brother, my sister, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. Now people add to it, somebody's been paying a low wage, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. But that silence is not just a march and a headline. What we're saying is we're doing the marching, we get the headline, but in very practical organizational ways, we're doing the counting. I'm a counter, Mike. Well, you know, I'm going to tell you something, and this is going to sound crazy to your audience. I learned something from Jesse Hams. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. Now, I didn't learn a lot from Jesse Hams.
Right.
Okay? I learned a lot, and I didn't agree with, you know, most of his part. The only thing I agreed with on Jesse Hams was his constituent services were the top. You know, my granddaddy almost lost his farm, and Jesse Hams, he called the office. And, you know, he sent people out there and made sure. Now, my granddad didn't even like Jesse Hams' policy. He was, but on that issue, his constituent service. When I was with a group of clergy one day, my father was involved in going to Capitol Hill and pushing things. We met with the senator. I was young, and my daddy told me, "Shut up and listen." Mm-hmm. Not like your mama.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in that meeting, and the guys were in there, and Jesse Hams came in, they were talking, and he said, "Boys," and I got hot. You know, I'm like, "Boys?
Yeah, boys? You have no boys in this room?"
Right. But my daddy hunched me and said, "Listen and learn," right? My father was very, very firebrand. But in that moment, he said, "Listen." He said, "Boys, I want to tell you all something." He said, "You know, I don't agree with much of what you say, and I have to plead 51%. That's what I have to do when I go back home. And I'll stay here as U.S. Senator. So it's been good to see you all today. Glad to talk to you." My dad took me. I said, "What'd you learn from that?" I said, "First of all," he said, "no, you didn't call me boy. I know who I am. What did you learn?" I said, well, he said all he was concerned about was 51%. He said, that man counts votes. He knows political power.
Mm-hmm.
He understands that to get elected, you got to get 51%. Now, you can talk all day long, but poor and low wealth people have to come together because, you know the story of Pharaoh where he made them make bricks without straw, and then he woke mm-hmm. up and said, wait a minute, it's more of them than it is
about. Right, right.
Okay, well, in this moment, the stones that the builders rejected have the power to become the chief cornerstones of building a greater, stronger, more flourishing democracy for everybody. But the stones cannot be unused. And so these 23 million poor and low wealth voters who have not voted, who are eligible, many are already registered, it's time now for us to wake this sleeping giant. And what we're saying, what we're talking about is not even radical. It's what people talk about is radical. A living wage is not radical, it's right. Healthcare is not radical. Every congressperson gets free healthcare. All they got to do is get elected.
Yeah, there is that. That's
it's
true.
Not radical.
That's true.
Right? That's all. And so that's why we're saying in this moment, we don't know yet what politics would look like. Well, Michael, what would life be like if those, you know, a current person won? I was looking at the other day, 70,000 votes in three states where over 3 million people didn't vote.
Yeah. It changes the game when they do.
Yeah.
It changes the game when they do. And that's the power of what we need to understand and appreciate about this moment. And it's why one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation with you, because you bring a level of clarity to this subject, and it is about recognizing the power you already have. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, in answer to the question that we had a little while ago, what's the vaccine for poverty? Well, it's when low-income people have the power to not only decide the elections, but also change the conversation about what is possible in the country, and is recognizing you already have that power. It was given to you 247 years ago. And now the question is, how do you use it? And whether or not the people you're electing, like Jesse Helms, appreciated that 51 changes the game. 51% changes the game. So go out and find your 51%.
I'm not leaving anything on the table. You know, I'm telling you, I had, you know, during COVID, I'll tell you this story to your audience and I'll let it go. You know, as a Christian, the one thing I know about Jesus is he went everywhere and organized folk. In fact, there's a text that says, I must needs go through Samaria. And even Jesus had to have some people with him. I mean, he said, I need some people. I don't need everybody but a remnant. And there's this great scripture in the prophets, Amos chapter 5, where God says, if I can just see a remnant that will stand up and cry and say, not on my watch, not in this time, then I will help you. And I'm one of those folk that just want to believe to find out if that scripture true.
Right. Right.
That if a remnant stands up, will justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream? But during COVID, you know, my doctors told me, if you can't catch COVID without a vaccine, you probably will die. I have a classmate in college, right, and he's that frank, because I have immune deficiencies and, you know, I battle diseases, arthritic disease that also causes some immune issues. So, you know, during COVID, I did. But then one young girl in our movement lost 25 members of her family.
Wow.
In a 30-mile radius, Mississippi refused to expand health care. Most of them didn't go to the hospital because they didn't have health care. And then I was pastoring at the time, and one of the families in the church lost 12 members of their family, right? And then I started hearing about these white people and black people, because it didn't matter to me. You know, the color is just for the demographic studies.
Right.
At the end of the day, they're human beings. And then I asked this question. Well, now I got real messed up, Mike. I mean, just messed up. I was home. I started crying. And I said, why am I still alive? all these folks dying don't have, I have health care. But why me? Why? I mean, why? Just why? And late over in the night, the spirit said, that is always the wrong question. Because you don't know. You, from birth to death, you don't know. You only have 6 minutes.
Right.
That's all. 6 minutes is about what all of us have. But this is the right question. What are you going to do with your 6 minutes or your 6 hours or your 60 days or whatever? Mm-hmm. The issue is not why are you still alive, but what are you going to do? And in this moment, when we see all of this stuff going on, and you know this, despots and demagogues play in the pain of people. You know, they, in other words, people who want to destroy society, they play in people's pain.
Yeah.
Demagogues and political demagogues, you know what I'm saying? They love to find people that are hurting and offer them false hope and false this and false that. And the real, only real antidote to that is for people of all people, of goodwill, religious, poor, low, to rise up and to engage. And so I'm saying to folk, if we're still here, then let's do something with it besides just exist. You know, if we're still here and we have the power to change the political system, then change it.
Right.
If we're still here and we've got the power to speak up, then speak up. If we're still here and we have the power to end child poverty and talk about the abolition of poverty, because Jesus did say the poor will be with you. But as a good Hebrew, as a good Jew, he would have been thinking about the entire scripture from Deuteronomy, which says the poor will be with you always because you do this, 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 and this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you would stop doing this, 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 this. This.
So the question isn't why you're here. The question is what you going to do while you're here. And that's the lesson. That's the lesson. Right. What you going to do while you're here. And I think that's an important one for a lot of us right now, not just in the context and framing of the politics of the moment, but the policy opportunities to realize and make real for a lot of people policies that will improve their lives. And it starts with what we can do. And I think it's an important lesson. It's not limited to those who have means. It is also afforded those who do not have those means. And mm-hmm. that is the reason why you do the work you do. Bishop Barber, I appreciate you coming on and sharing a word with us about that work, galvanizing and leveling up the conversation for the poor in our country to exercise their franchise and to vote in their interests. So we appreciate you for that, sir.
Thank you so much. And as they say, keep doing what you do, Brother Michael.
You too, my friend. Yes, I really appreciate you. You know that, I hope. Bishop William J. Barber II. It's always a pleasure. He is the president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach and national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. It has been an honor to have you in the conversation today. Folks, don't forget to follow the good bishop on Twitter at Rev Dr. Barber. That's Dr. Barber. And check out the good work of the on behalf of the poor at www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. And check out the upcoming march that's happening on March 2nd, which will be a good work indeed. Until now, next time, y'all be safe, be well, and not just think about the poor, but help them act on what they can do. God bless y'all. Take care.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.